Carnivore Theology, a podcast that answers questions about the Christian faith to help you grow from milk to meat into wise, skilled, world-changing followers of Jesus Christ. With theologian and pastor Chad Graham, author and pastor Al Desjardins, and me, your host, Steve Bastian. Today's question is, the news these days are full of stories about the terrible things ISIL is doing in the name of their religion. What should be the Christian response to these acts of terrorism?
Well, guys, it's kind of fun to be watching hockey with you, especially when the Flames are the superior team.
Yeah, my prediction for tonight is that the Flames are going to go up to 500 and that the Oilers are going to tank and continue their season-long losing streak. But that's just, you know, my prophetic voice speaking there. No guarantees.
At least we have a streak. So there. To be honest, guys, I'm depressed. Like, I'm sitting here, and not only am I an Oilers fan trying to watch this thing, I'm watching Oilers versus LA, which is even more depressing because it harkens back to the days of trading. And even though we all decided to applaud Peter Pocklington when he came over, what was that all about? Every time I think about that, I still get depressed. And then we're sitting here, and all of a sudden the news comes on. And you know what? To be honest, guys, just turn off the hockey game. I'm done. I'm just depressed. I don't know if there's anything that can make this night go better. I have to watch a Flames game, and then I have to watch my Oilers lose. And then we're talking about terrorism, and all of a sudden, boom, terrorism. Could it get any worse?
It could get worse. You know, you could have your player there, Nuge, of the Oilers, get injured. You know, one of your star player down and out for a few weeks.
Yeah, that'd be terrible.
There's nothing that makes me more superstitious and get rid of my biblical thinking than hockey, and you shouldn't say things like that.
That's just minimizing the point. Really, we're watching the news, and you know, it's CBC shows lots of world-breaking news, and we've had over the weeks all these reports of ISIL and the things that they're doing, beheading journalists and then recording it and to make that a fear propaganda. I try to keep up with the newspapers, but I only get little tidbits. But I know, Chad, you're a person that really tries to follow the media and look at it from a biblical worldview. So I just want you to actually start sharing. If you can give us some information about ISIL, that would be great.
Because of this 24-hour news cycle that they've got, they've coming up with all this rumor and all this mess, and then they state it as fact, and then it's different the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to even figure out what's going on, let alone what we should be talking about.
Yeah, it's even the very name of the organization, right? I think Steve was calling them ISIL. He's obviously following President Obama. ISIL is for the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Sometimes they're known as ISIS. Sometimes they're just known as the Islamic State, which I believe is their preferred designation. And that does seem to be gaining popularity, IS. Mostly, I think, because young ladies in the West are frequently named ISIS, and they're feeling a little bit awkward, so we had to make sure that changed. I'm only half kidding. That was in the National Post today. These gals are going on YouTube saying, "My name is ISIS, and I'm proud of it." And then they reject the terrorist group. But the Islamic State, really, fundamentally, all we really need to know about them is that a couple of years ago, they were kicked out of Al-Qaeda because Al-Qaeda felt they were too ill-disciplined and radical. So when Al-Qaeda thinks you're radical, my guess is you're probably pretty crazy going nuts.
Yeah.
And having been kicked out, they basically have gone on a tear. Now, there is a major issue with what happened in Iraq after the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Despite warnings that it would leave a vacuum of chaos in its wake, the pullout probably wasn't done in the most measured way, but it happened. And in the power vacuum that was left, the Islamic State, ISIL, ISIS, was able to rise. But I think that if we're really to understand them, more than looking at the last couple of years, which are only a little bit of give or take, it's actually part of a much larger movement. And the thing I think that we properly need to understand is that the Islamic State is really the third wave of the great conflicts of Islam with the Western world powers. Maybe you guys don't know that, but in the very founding of Islam, it was part and parcel tied into Muhammad's quest for revenge against his hometown of Mecca, from which he was kicked out of. And so in 611 AD, when he received his first purported visions from an angel he believed to be Gabriel, he had a personal and familial grudge against Mecca, and it was not too unsurprising that many of the angel's revelations to him were about how he had the right to take vengeance on the Meccans. And so there are a bunch of key battles that were fought. The Battle of Badr is famous in 624, the Battle of Uhud in 625, the Battle of Medina, or the Siege of Medina, or Trench in 627, and finally in 629, Muhammad successfully conquered Mecca. And just a couple of years later, he would die. And as he died, there was this transitional period, and Islam didn't know its identity and what to do with itself, and there was a, as happens so often, a necessity to look outward to keep themselves together. And so they began basically an expansion which they envisioned to be a struggle for global conquest. And from about 632 till 1099, they had almost uninterrupted conquest throughout the world. They attacked and took North Africa. They attacked and took the area we now call Israel. They took Asia Minor. These were all Christian lands of the Eastern or Byzantine Empire, and they fell one after the other. In the 8th century, Southern Europe was invaded, and Spain fell to the Muslim onslaught. Parts of France fell. In the East, Georgia was captured in 738. Crete fell in 820. Southern Italy was successfully invaded in 827, and Rome was sacked by Muslim armies in 846. And so at this period of time, all of Europe hung in the balance. And there were a few great battles that essentially saved Europe from a total collapse. The most famous, you probably know, is the Battle of Tours, where Charles Martel, or Charles the Hammer, received his name. In the 730s, a large Muslim invasion force got into northwest France and looked like it was going to take all of Gaul. But Martel, in perhaps the greatest moment of Frankish history, defeated them and saved Christian Europe from this onslaught. Basically, apart from this and a couple of other key battles that were fought at this period of time, we would all be Muslims today and we wouldn't be having carnivore theology. So that kind of is the first great one. The second one I'll be quicker on because we know it better is a series of military campaigns which were the West's counterpunch, and they've become known as the Crusades. They're often vilified, and it certainly must be admitted that much evil was done, but these were wars of defense and reconquest which ultimately secured Western freedom and resulted in the world that we have today. So as much as we might want to decry aspects of bad things done, we really ought to be extremely grateful that the Crusades actually happened. I know that sounds very strange and countercultural today, but that's just historical reality. Now with the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and these other groups, we're entering the third great conflict with Islam. But here's the scary part, guys. For the first time, we're doing so without a united Christendom. Even after the Reformation, when Protestants and Roman Catholics were fighting with one another, when there was an Islamic invasion from the East, the Holy Roman Empire came together and a peace was settled between the different parties so they could send a unified army out, and they went out and successfully defeated the Muslim invader again in the 16th century. So the great question really for Western civilization today is, will the West awaken to its danger before it falls? And that's where we need to see ISIS fitting in. Although it's a single group in the Middle East, it's a large and fairly powerful one. It has huge tracts of land. It does have oil reserves. It's taking city after city. And really, the West to date hasn't seemed to have the stomach to do much to stop them. Does that make a little more sense of where these guys are coming from? This is part of a 1,500-year-old conflict. Never changed. Aspects in their culture hate us, and aspects in our culture hate them, and it's been this eternal state of warfare.
Well, we've been able to focus our minds, and at least to wrap my brain around Osama bin Laden. He was the bad guy. He was the key bad guy. We had to go get him. You know, he's the Al-Qaeda bad guy. I'm having a hard time wrapping my brain around who we're actually fighting in ISIS and the Islamic State, and who the bad guy is, or what even what country we're fighting. Or we're supposed to be who the heck am I even afraid of? Because all of a sudden they have an announcement to all of their people around the world, please go ahead and start chopping people's head off. And especially, by the way, Canada would be great if you could start doing it there. And I'm thinking, good gravy, you know, who am I worried about?
This is really the terrifying thing in here. And of course, you will see disagreements between Muslims on their beliefs, just like you see in any other religion. But fundamentally, this is a religious movement. This is rooted in the eschatology of the Quran. And what they're looking for is to set up a universal caliphate, over which, interestingly enough, the Lord Jesus Christ will return to rule, and he will explain to the world that Christians were wrong and that he was really Muslim. And then they will usher in the era of the, what do they call him, the fourth imam, or the final Muslim leader. And Muhammad returns and all of their eschatology happens. So they're waiting for this to happen and moving for this to happen. So that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to set up the universal caliphate, conquer the world, actually, literally. They've stated and want to put the black flag over the White House and so on. And they want Muslims all around the world to rise up. And so part of the strategy is sending agents into all of these countries. You know, there are parts of London and parts of Paris that the local police will no longer go to. They're under Islamic law. And you see the riots in France where they burn the cars and just cause chaos when anything goes on.
Well, then again, who's they? Like, you keep saying they. Who's they? Who's them?
Muslims who buy into this vision of the theology of Islam. Really, around the world, the majority. That's the majority position. The moderate Muslims are those that have adapted to Western culture. They, of course, pose no threat to us other than philosophical belief system threats. But that's not the way most of them are living. The individuals tend not to necessarily feel that way, but by being born in these cultures, they're forced into it. You can't convert out of Islam in an Islamic country. It's a capital offense, so you tend not to convert out. And the education that they receive is pretty biased and one-sided. Most of the Islamic countries, including the Palestinian territories, textbooks teach them that their sole duty in life is to kill Jews.
I have a question for you, Chad.
I was
reading a little bit of a book. I can't remember any of the author right now. Global Jihad is the name of the book. And the bit that I've read so far, I haven't got through it, but it sounds very much like this jihadist concept. It's very much state and religion are completely unified.
Yes.
And wherever this movement goes, you know, it's a strong sense of politically they want to take control of it as well. And it's
absolutely
not it's not this like our North American culture so much of your religion is completely separate from state, and it's, you know, every once in a while we have these little bumps, and a few things we've talked about where these bumps have occurred. So what do you think of that, Chad? Am I perceiving that accurately?
No, that's exactly right. That's why they're demanding Sharia law all around the world, including Canada. Looks like Quebec is actually bowing to the pressure, and they'll be running Sharia law there. Christianity had experience of this, right, where we had churches and states that were mixed together. Those actually, interestingly enough, like the Church of England, for example, were national movements that essentially used the church to unify. Even the papacy at the height of the medieval power was really an expression of the Roman Empire. Where this is a very different philosophy, this is a very integrationist philosophy, and yeah, there cannot and is not and will never be any possibility of separation. Their theology can't allow for it. So you have to reject elements of Islam in order to reject that, and of course those that are faithful wouldn't be willing to do that. Compromisers always will.
So we've talked a little bit about who and what this entity is.
Mm-hmm.
And here in Canada, me sitting here in your basement, what do I do next? You know, what as a Christian, how should I respond to this? Because it feels like a way bigger question than I can deal with, but I know that as believers we need to do something.
I know, and you know, here's where we're stuck, because we're also citizens of our region, right? And I think for me, what we have to understand too, and I'll make this really brief, is the massive change and shift that's happening in our culture and civilization. You guys are old enough, I'm old enough, in the last 30-some years, we've seen tremendous changes in our world. And what we've basically seen is what they're now calling the death of modernity. From the 16th to the 20th centuries, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the Reformation, all these powerful movements moved the Western world forward through the scientific and industrial revolutions, religious thinking and advances, and colonialization and all of that. But the Western powers were always tempered by Christian virtues, and our culture was always influenced by Christian thinking. And so it wasn't entirely parasitic. With any negatives we brought, Western hegemony also brought the spread of Christianity, hospitals, education, sanitization, civilization throughout the world. But the West has exhausted itself. It's done. The Enlightenment experiment is done. Modernity is dead. And we have a massive, aching vacuum that's left. We have no moral center. We have eroded our sense of purpose, and we don't know who we are. We don't know what it means to be a Canadian, an American, a Westerner. We're unwilling to say that we have something to export. We're embarrassed about our past. All of our politicians are apologizing for everything we've ever done. Now, of course, we've done bad things, as every country has, and we ought to perhaps apologize for them, but what about the good? One of the things indicative of our culture is the news. I don't know if you guys caught it the last couple weeks, but thousands of girls, teenage girls from Canada, U.S., Britain, disappeared. and they went into Iraq and into Syria to become jihadi wives. It's been in the papers, and absolutely shocking thing. You see, because there's no moral center, because there's no purpose for them in this vacuum, they've been stuck in middle-class homes, in our education systems, born here, raised here, although Muslim background families, or converted into Muslim faith, and they're 18 years old, and ISIS has gone onto Twitter and into Facebook, and they said, come join the jihad, become a jihadi wife, marry one of our jihadi warriors, cook for him, and bear his children. And thousands of them said, yeah, forget Toronto, forget London, forget New York, here I go. It's a little different than going to college. Mm-hmm. As citizens, we need to realize that we're sitting in a culture much like the culture that Augustine was in when he wrote The City of God. Rome is falling. The barbarians are invading. And we may or may not recover. As Christians, we need to be able to do exactly what Augustine did and realize that our hope doesn't lie in Rome. Our hope lies in God. And whatever uncertainties come, this is not ever going to hurt the church. I think that's where the amazing change comes. As much as our civilization is tired, and our church is, as far as institutions may be tired, Christ Church is not tired.
Right. Well, and from a pastoral perspective, you know, answering the question as a pastor, as a Christian, and things like that, what jumps to mind in my mind is Hebrews chapter 2. And what it says this is, in putting everything under Jesus, God left nothing that is not subject to him. Mm-hmm. We stand here and we go, okay, that's wonderful. But then the next line says, yet at present we do not see everything subject to him. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. In bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. And then he goes on to say, since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held slavery by the fear of death. And when I think of that, the fear that comes up and the trepidation and the anxiety, and we're, you know, what is this world coming to, and we're losing our identity, and who are we even anymore? Hebrews is written for that. The book of Hebrews was written to a group of Christians who were under such a fierce attack that they were strongly considering leaving the church, just giving it all up. So the preacher of Hebrews writes them a letter, and it has a threefold message. Number one, he says, listen, wherever you're thinking of going, there's nowhere better to go than Jesus. So if you're a Christian under persecution, the temptation is to give up. If you're a Christian living, even in Canada, under the frustration of what it is to be a Christian in Canada, let alone a Christian that is in Iraq, Iran, or, you know, in the Jordan Valley, that we're tempted to give up, go back to your old life as a pagan, because it's easier and it's safer. But Hebrews says, listen, what you're even considering is foolish. Yeah, it might help you now, but to deny Jesus is to forfeit your soul.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, as in a pastoral application, I think of that, and I think when we're going to respond to terrorism here and abroad, the first thing we got to do is we got to stay close to Jesus.
Yes.
We've got to be praying. We've got to keep building our faith, and we should not be surprised this is happening because Jesus warned us this would happen, but we shouldn't give up. We've got to press in closer to Jesus. Keep good teaching in front of us. Don't get caught up in all the idle talk and the myths and all these distracting doctrines that are just taking up our time, but really focus on the gospel of Jesus Christ, because tough times are coming, and they're going to test our faith, and they're going to show us our spiritual weak points. And if we're at that time of rest, like, praise God that we here are at a spiritual time of rest, and we can take that time away. We're not under attack. There's nobody banging on our door asking us, are you a Christian, with an AK-47 in our mouth. We can build our faith so we can be ready for that tough stuff when it comes.
Mm-hmm. Just to jump on what you just said there and to recognize the reality here, as I talked about our culture being exhausted, part of that is our Christianized culture being exhausted. And what's left in a vacuum is these powerful influences from these other cultures coming in, or power.
Mm-hmm.
Power is the only thing that will hold us together. And I think that's what we're starting to see. Just news this week, 4 bullet points. Christian business owners in the U.S. have been told they have to pay for abortions or lose their businesses. The mayor and council of Houston, Texas, have ordered pastors to turn over their sermons for review Canadian human rights tribunals are going after Christians for noting the historic Christian teaching which condemns homosexuality as a sinful and aberrant lifestyle. Trinity Western University, Christian University, is in a pitched battle to get its law school started because of anti-Christian bigotry in our law societies, mm-hmm. very similar to the went through with the BC mm-hmm. Teachers Federation a decade or so ago. The age of rest might very well be over to us, and I think pastorally, Al, we've got to go your direction. We've got to turn back to Christ.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why the second thing that you build on, and for those who are under this kind of persecution or those that will be, the second reminder of the book of Hebrews is to be reminded of our ultimate deliverance, to open up our view past what is going on in front of us and into eternity. Mm. So the idea, over and over and over and over and over, you read in Hebrews, hang in there, stay with Jesus. Jesus is God. Jesus is better than Moses. He will deliver you even better than Moses did. Jesus is a better high priest, and he hears your prayer. Jesus is the anchor of your hope, and that's where you can be firm and secure. Jesus is the perfect sacrifice for your sin, and that's the only way you can be saved. There's nowhere else to go, so hold unswervingly to the hope that we profess, because he who promised is faithful. So when you're looking for that deliverance and you're under all of this oppression, if you look to Christ, and I know that we as pastors are supposed to say that, as Christians are supposed to say that, but the argument of Hebrews is, where else are you going to go? Hang in there, because the other side of the equation is coming. Hebrews also says, it is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of God. So when God calls in the chips, even though it's been a mess down here, a mess in your life and under persecution, when that comes, don't be on the wrong side of the equation. And then he gives a whole list of faithful people who hung in there during hard times. They didn't see the promises of God to come to fruition. They lived through these horrible times of persecution. They were promised things by God and didn't actually see them happen until generations after they were dead. Hmm. And it says, be like them. Do not grow weary. Do not grow weary in the struggle. Persevere, endure. You have to do this, because if you don't, you're going to be in serious trouble when you get locked into the finiteness of this world. If you get locked into thinking this is all there is, you're in trouble. This life isn't the only life. Therefore, if you keep storing up your treasures here, you're going to be in trouble. You got to look towards heaven. You have to prioritize God's priorities of peacemaking and love, obedience to him, because that's what's going to endure. All the rest of it's going to burn.
Do you know what that makes me think, Al? That looking and that perception, that has to jump back into this world. And what I mean by that is, you just said we have the sense where we see all of our hope in this world, and we have to look to God's world for our hope. He's going to cast the chips in and so on. But the reality is that that world is already in our world, and we're in what we understand to be spiritual warfare. You know, much of what I talked about earlier, if our culture has a vacuum, it's going to be, we have three choices. Power. Give our politicians more power to control our lives and keep us safe. Buy into another ideology like Islam or something else. Or return to Christian roots.
Well, and that's the whole point of Hebrews, is, okay, let's evaluate these choices.
Entirely right, because they were evaluating, do they go back into Judaism? Do they stick with Christ? How do they deal with the oppression that's coming upon them? Well, let me give you a three-point L matrix then.
Can you do that? Are you allowed to? Is he allowed to do that?
I give him the authority.
All right.
Matthew 5:44, Jesus said, pray for your enemies. Be apologetically prepared. 1 Peter 3:15, honor Christ as Lord, Christ the Lord rather as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason that hopes within you. If our church can't do that, and many can't, then we're going to lose to a powerful ideology like Islam or to the government pressure for power. Third, be faithful, for we are in a spiritual battle. God's world, the spiritual world, is already here. And our weapons are not of the flesh. We are not like Islam. We do not need to conquer any territories or take up any arms. We destroy speculations and every lofty thing that is raised up against the knowledge of God, taking every thought captive to Christ. And so I would say, Elementrix-wise, get on your knees, get in your Bible. And I think in our generation, all Christians need to study some basic apologetics. Don't leave it to professionals. Don't leave it to pastors. We have to, and when I say that, I don't mean some massive, complex, philosophical thing. I mean, know what you actually believe and why. Know why it's different than the major ideologies that are out there today. And defend them to honor Christ in your hearts. We have to be active. There's my little L matrix. I just
You did good, but you missed one.
What's the last one?
The last one would be stick together.
Ah,
which is the message, the last message of Hebrews, and that's the only way that we're going to get through this is if the church sticks together. So, yeah, you could sit in your basement and study apologetics all you want, pray your guts out, and be ready in your Bible, but you need the church. We need to stick together. The whole message of the end part of Hebrews is yes. Do not give up meeting together. Stay strong and persevere by sticking together. Make every effort to live at peace with each other. Keep on living as brothers. Take care of the strangers. Visit the prisoners. Take care of your marriages and stick together. Take care of your leaders and obey them. Encourage one another in faith and good deeds. When people are missing things, share with them. So what can we do? I mean, if the question is, what can we do? And absolutely, I totally agree with you. Let's get our heads wrapped around this. Let's make sure that we're good, strong spiritually. We are doing combat spiritually, and we're prepared apologetically to make a defense for our faith. But also, let's stick together, because part of this is going to be the fear of not sticking out as a Christian, staying home on Sundays, being afraid. What do we do with these people across the world? Well, we have a chance to help them. Maybe we send help from this side of the world to the other. We pray for one another. Hey, if the bad guys can send wives to take care of the other really bad guys, then maybe we could send something their way, you know, to the good guys, right?
And isn't that directly all in Hebrews there? What is it, 14:3 or 14:4? Care for those who are imprisoned? The idea there was that those guys had been taken into prison and they needed support. They wouldn't get food in a Roman prison.
Yeah.
So if you brought them food and blankets, you could be identified as a conspirator with those Christians and possibly thrown in jail yourself.
Absolutely.
And they were afraid. And that's where you're keep together. If you went to a Christian church, you could be marked. Mm-hmm. I should have said that, but I was trying to come up with an LM matrix during a fuzz point. Fully with you there.
Well, and I mean, we have the opportunity in Canada to make ourselves ready to maybe even house refugees mm-hmm. if they're going to come, you know, that we can send good teachers to these Christians who need good teaching.
Yep.
We can be open to serving Christians around the world whenever we can, but it doesn't start there, and I this is going to sound funny, but it has to start within the walls of our own church. It has to start with us taking care of each other, being mindful of each other, yes, taking care of our own souls, yes, taking care of our own minds, yes, taking care of our own spirits, but then also having that bubble out into each other and taking care of the people in our church, being an Acts 2 church, which also means we go out to the world and we take care of the people in the world, the other Christians in the world, during their tough times too, whatever that means.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, Alan. And I painted a bit of a bleak picture, so I should just put a little positive spin in here. We've been in very tough times before. Do you know that England, during the 17th and 18th century, was an abysmal wasteland of corruption, oppression. Nobody went to church. Christianity was essentially dead. Paganism was all over the place. The powerful oppressed the weak. Politics were corrupt. Prisons were miserable. And you know what happened? A couple guys started preaching the gospel. It became known as the Great Awakening. The whole country changed. The prison systems were reformed. The political system was reformed. The welfare system was reformed. The work week was established. And all of the society turned around because the gospel was primary. And there are people who are prepared to address with the gospel the issues in their culture. And if we're the same way today, we face an ISIS threat. We face a terrorist threat. We face all these things. If we start with the gospel, we can see things radically turn around here. And then we can bring hope to the rest of the world again.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for that word, Chad.
Yeah, that's awesome, because it's pretty easy to get run down with watching the news, reading the paper, of how bad things are, how evil seems to be the predominant thing out there. Yeah, we need to know that, you know, the church has gone through, and Christians have gone through tough times. You look at Job. I mean, that guy went through a lot.
Mm.
You know, but yet, the Lord was with him and blessed him. And you know, we have to sometimes realize that our blessings aren't necessarily always going to happen in this lifetime. We have such a prosperity gospel culture.
Amen. You know who God does bless better, though, is a Flames fan over an Oilers fan.
You know, that's not proven. Well, contrary to evidence, that is not proven.
All I can say is second period, Flames are up 2-1, and the Oilers have to fight the Kings tonight, and that's just going to be, you know, we know it's going to be a bloodbath.
All right, you know what? I'm going to just cheer myself up by watching that hockey game. And you're going to be wrong. You're going to be wrong.
This has been Carnivore Theology with Chad, Al, and Steve. Thank you for listening today as we discussed ISIL. To find out more about Carnivore Theology, or if you have any topics or questions you want us to cover on upcoming episodes, let us know by visiting us at our website, www.carnivoretheology.com. If you like what we're doing, please like us on Facebook, rate and subscribe to us on iTunes, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. We encourage you to connect with your local biblical church and keep your eyes on the cross.